This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. Dan Mish's participation is in his personal capacity for this interview. The opinions expressed are the author's own and do not reflect the view of the Department of Energy of the United States government. Enjoy today's episode. This episode is sponsored by Verizon. Are you ready for your next assignment? As a leading communications technology company, Verizon is always looking for experienced leaders to step forward and help us stay competitive in the global marketplace. More than 10,000 veterans contribute their skills across our entire business. We're proud to work alongside them each day and fortunate to benefit from their outstanding skills, discipline, and experience. To learn more about joining our team, check out verizon.com/military. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help the military community succeed in their civilian career. Today is episode number 318, Navy to Clean Tech and the Department of Energy with Dan Mish.
And here, I think that clean energy gives an opportunity for veterans to find that mission alignment in the facts that the transition to clean energy is going to make our national security better by, reducing our reliance on foreign fuels, by making our domestic systems more resilient against both cyber and physical threats, by mitigating the impacts that climate change is going to have on our military and international relations, as well as the investments that are going into that, both from the science and the economic perspectives that are going to give us the soft power necessary to continue projecting U.S. values well into the future.
One aspect that I loved about my conversation with Dan is how his story exemplifies a middle road for veterans. Often, I interview veterans who take a wildly different career path after their military experience. I also interview many veterans who take a career path that is directly related to their military experience. Dan found a way to split the difference. His career path utilized one piece of his military experience while also allowing him to branch into an entirely different industry. We talk about how he made the switch from submarines into the clean energy space. We talk about the rapid growth occurring in this industry and why mission-oriented veterans might love this field. Dan also served during the time of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy and shares his experience of coming out to his wardroom. This aspect of my conversation helped me build empathy and understanding for someone who had the exact same military career path that I did, yet was impacted by a policy in a way that I had never had to experience. For listeners who enjoy this episode, check out these three episodes, which I'll link to in our show notes at beyonduniform.org. Episode 186, Army Veteran to Blockchain and Ethereum at Consensus with Donnie Benjamin. Episode number 221, Navy Veteran to the Cannabis Industry at Cannacraft with Shireen Griffith. And episode 213, Navy Veteran to Cybersecurity at FireEye with Lauren Burnell. While these three interviews are not about clean technology, they each share a commonality of covering industries that are new and rapidly growing. They are also all relatively new industries. This means that there aren't a lot of people who have decades of experience in these fields, so a military veteran who is a newcomer to the space doesn't have as much ground to catch up on. As always, at beyonduniform.org, you'll find show notes with a text transcript of this interview, links to everything we discuss, and over 300 episodes just like this. If you haven't signed up for our newsletter yet, make sure that you do. We're releasing a lot of new events and offers through the newsletter. Be sure to check it out. So with that, let's dive into my conversation with Dan. Well, joining me today in Chicago, Illinois, my guest is Dan Mish. Dan, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, for listeners, Dan is the Federal Project Director with the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Science. He is also a Senior Fellow of the Atlantic Council Global Energy Center and the founder of the Veterans Advanced Energy Summit. He started out at the Naval Academy, after which he served on submarines for 5 years, including three nuclear deterrent patrols, and he is a member of the Truman National Security Project Defense Council and Energy Expert Group. So Dan, to start things off, what's not in the bio that you want listeners to know?
I have a 155-pound Great Dane, And it's been quite an adventure now. She's 2 years old, and I tell people I'm a zookeeper.
I bet, man.
It's just that much work.
We've got a Chihuahua Jack Russell mix, and every time I pick up after him on a walk, I am grateful for not having a great day, and you are a brave man on that one.
Yeah, well, it takes two. My partner and I got married last year, and it's been one of our many adventures together.
I bet. Well, let's actually start with, if you're open to it, I loved your article. I'll put it in the show notes for listeners. You wrote an article on the war horse, and you kind of served in that strange in-between period when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was still in effect. And I'd love for you to share with listeners anything that you'd want to from that experience and what that was like for you.
Yeah, being at the Naval Academy under Don't Ask, Don't Tell was especially hard during your college years that are, you know, meant to be fun. Not that the Naval Academy is all that much fun to begin with, but it was even harder for me being forced into the closet. I almost didn't make it. Actually, in my second year, when you sign your contracts, I was very, very close to quitting. I didn't go to class for 2 weeks while I decided what to do. And I'm very glad that I did stick it out. It is really proven beneficial for my career and just a part of who I am today. But there were sacrifices that I made in those remaining 2 years and then before the repeal, where I really just lived two different lives, kind of my professional Navy life and all of my friends and personal things were just kept separate from that. And as difficult as that was, I was very fortunate to be in the service when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. And I think that the impact that that had on me was astounding. And that's part of what I write about in the War Horse article, which is it only took one friend to really change everything for me. There was another lieutenant on the submarine. We had surfed together already at that point for like two and a half years, but we didn't know much about each other. We weren't friends. We didn't hang out at all. He happened to move apartments right into my neighborhood. And so we started spending a little bit of time together. And I don't think the repeal had gone into effect, but maybe it had been approved in DC. And so for me, that was a weight lifted, like change was coming. And it gave me the ability to come out to him, which was really no problem. All along, it wasn't going to be a problem. And he and I just became fast friends, spending a lot more time together outside of work, which made things more enjoyable at work. And we were also then, in maybe right around the same time, the two senior lieutenants in the wardroom. And I think that our friendship brought the wardroom, the rest of the wardroom together. And by the time that I left the submarine in 2012, we had a really strong fellowship of junior officers in that group. And I think it just goes to prove that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a bad compromise. It was a policy of necessity to stop the witch hunts that had been happening before then, but that ultimately it was a failed policy, and I'm really glad to see that things have changed since then.
That's great. And I don't know for our listeners what percentage served during that period where that was repealed. For me, when I was at the Naval Academy, I graduated 2002. And so like this was, it was completely different world. Mm-hmm. And for me, it wasn't really until, like you, I did 5 years on submarines and I went to grad school. That was kind of the eye-opening experience for me, seeing so many different diverse backgrounds and starting to gain empathy and understanding. So especially for listeners who may be in a similar position, people who have been in the military longer, I'd encourage you to check out Dan's article because it's eye-opening to see what that experience was like for someone with Dan's background. And for me, it was, I think it was like an eye-opening experience. And I think our listeners would benefit from understanding what it's like to be in an environment where you have to hide who you are and where you can't fully be accepted for who you are. And I think the last thing I'll say, especially for those of us, I think we can come from privilege and not have that experience and not have any understanding of what that would be like. I think it's really incumbent on us to understand what that's like. And this is just one example, you know, that Dan went through of not being able to fully be himself. But there's many examples in our society where that's true. And I thought the article was really well written, Dan.
Yeah, thank you. I think that being your authentic self is very important to leadership. And after the repeal, I was able to be my whole self in that leadership position, and it really showed.
That's great. Yeah, 100% agree too. I think living in alignment is a very big principle for me. And I think that that's a powerful example, like being your authentic self in leadership. Well, let's walk through. I think you have a unique story, or maybe not too unique, when it comes to your leaving the military. And from what I understand, it wasn't a out of the Navy into a career. There was a lot of searching. And I'd love for you to share a little bit more about your experience of going from active duty and ultimately landing your first job, but how you got there.
Yeah, my transition out of the military was very difficult. Having signed up for the Navy when I was 17, my parents technically signed the dotted line. And that was my whole life. The military told me where to be and when and what to wear. And so when I left in 2012, I did not have a very clear path for what I wanted to do. I enjoyed my work on the submarine, and I was in the shipyard for a good period of that, and so worked with the group called Naval Reactors that oversees those construction projects, and was pursuing the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, because it would kind of fit inside my skill set. And I also thought that a military to government service transition would be fairly easy given a lot of the similarities. During that time, so I left in May, I took a couple of months off and then didn't really start pursuing the job hunt too seriously until maybe September of that year. And it took a lot longer than I thought it was. It was April before I actually had the job, and it wasn't with the NRC. In fact, it was with the Department of Energy. While I was pursuing those NRC opportunities, there are a couple offices here in Chicago. I started learning more about the Department of Energy and the two labs that they have here, both Argonne National Lab and Fermi National Lab. And I'm really glad that I ended up where I did, because had I gone to the NRC, that's really nuclear and nuclear only. And during that time of transition, I was starting to learn a lot more about climate change and the importance that our clean energy transition is going to have on our national security. And so by being with the Department of Energy and a national lab in particular, I'm exposed to a lot more of those different technology types and kind of a front row seat to see how our investments in science and technology are making the country safer.
That's great. What I love about this aspect of your story is that it's leveraging the career capital, or some of the career capital you built up in the Navy. You had experience in energy, and so you're leveraging that, but you're also getting one foot out on a plank that's a little bit further away, because it's not nuclear energy. It's not the area that you focused on. And I think that that's a great example for listeners to see that you can leverage a piece of your experience while broadening into something new. I know many of the guests on the show have left the military and gone into something wildly different. Mm-hmm. And there's many who have gone onto things very closely related. And I think your story illustrates that in-between zone that can give you a leg up while also letting you explore something new.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, behind the scenes, I was not too smart about my money. Mm-hmm. I had saved up some during my time in the Navy, but in the 11 months that it took from when I left to my next job, I went through all of that. Chicago is a good cost of living comparably to a lot of the rest of the country, especially on the coasts, but I still did not prepare properly. And I think that for anyone else that's getting out, that really is my number one piece of advice, is to fully understand your financial situation and how much time you have. And, to recognize that the job hunt may take a lot longer than you plan on. So reserve those resources as much as you can.
Yeah, and that's definitely a theme in the 300 plus interviews is for nearly everyone, it takes longer than they expect. And for nearly everyone, they have not prepared financially. So Dan is not the exception on that. But I hope listeners take that to heart if you're still on active duty, that chances are you're going to take a little bit longer than you think, and you're going to need more money than you think.
How many of your interviewers developed a nut allergy as a result?
None that have disclosed it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I had an incident at the peak of my stress right before I was about to run out of money, before the job offer came in. I had an anaphylactic reaction to a walnut, and it was stress related. So I spent 7 years with a nut allergy, and I'm happy to report that I just recovered from that. And that's about how long I think it took to recover from my transition.
I mean, it's real, right? This amount of stress of not, I mean, I think especially for the male members of our audience, I think that it's a little bit more common to associate self-worth with ability to earn or provide or have a clear purpose. And, but it's probably universally true for veterans as well. And so to not have that and to be grasping for what you're going to do next and be worrying about a diminishing cash flow for the first time in your life, I think your story illustrates how real that pressure is and the physical consequences that that can bring about.
And I think resources like yours were very helpful for me during that time, just being able to hear what other people are going through, knowing that you're not alone, and understanding what resources are available out there.
Thank you. Thank you. So what, maybe let's actually fast forward a little bit. You've got a couple different things, or three different things in your title in the bio. But if you ran into someone who's in the military on the street and they said, "Dan, what do you do for a living?" How do you answer that? How do you explain what you're doing right now?
I tell people that I'm defending our country. I truly believe that, you know, even though the uniform is off, that the work that I do today is making our country safer. And I point to, say, GPS, which was in fact a military invention before its adoption, its wide adoption and other uses. The work that I do today helps the government invest in new technology that's going to make us stronger, like clean energy.
That's great. And maybe for those not familiar with the space, like, there's the, let's just call it the energy industry. And in the military, you're exposed to the nuclear part of that. But could you maybe lay out the land of, like, what are the different sectors within energy that listeners could even consider?
So there, gosh, big global picture. The energy industry is segmented into fuels, generation, distribution and transmission. And then you could also look at energy efficiency from the buildings side of thing, the end user, as well as transportation like motor vehicles. The work that I do in advanced energy is focused mostly on next generation technology. And that's more related to what I do at Argonne National Laboratory in the research and development space.
Great. And so let's maybe unpack one by one. So you're federal project director with the U.S. Department of Energy and their Office of Science. What does that look like on a day-to-day? What sort of activities are you engaged with?
So Argonne National Laboratory is one of 10 Office of Science laboratories around the country, and they conduct research and development in basic science that industry may consider too risky to invest. So very early stage technology. Argonne actually started after the Manhattan Project as a nuclear lab. I think almost every nuclear power plant in operation today was invented right here outside of Chicago, including the nuclear reactor that I operated on a submarine. So it's a lot of fun for me to be able to come back where everything started, kind of as a full circle moment for me. It's actually another reason why my background in the nuclear Navy helped me with the job that I have today. As a federal project director, I'm engaged in a number of policy programs and projects. Typically, I summarize to say that if the government is going to invest, say, more than $10 million, then There's typically a government person that's there to assist in the execution of that program. The work that I do is a fairly wide portfolio. It includes the acquisition of next generation supercomputers, the construction and demolition of new and aging buildings, the maintenance and development of the infrastructure that supports that backbone of science. So the electricity, for instance, but then also on the policy and program side, looking at the partnerships that the lab has with foreign entities in other countries that the government would be very interested in understanding what those projects are from a export control and counterintelligence perspective.
And I'm assuming that a background in science is helpful, if not essential, and that coming from submarines is probably a leg up. But any advice for someone listening who may have been in the Air Force or may not have a science background? Is this a career path to rule out, or is there a possibility of breaking in?
No, definitely not. Just like the energy industry at large, there are skills needed in almost every area, not just in the technical, which my job lends itself to quite well based on the skills that I got. But in contracting and business development, I think those other skills, ultimately what the military prepares you for is a large amount of responsibility and the ability to communicate and work with other people. So across the board, I think that those are beneficial traits that just about anybody should be looking for.
That's great. And you are also a senior fellow of the Atlantic Council Global Energy Center. What does that mean? What do you do there?
So the Atlantic Council is a DC-based think tank, and I was fortunate to participate in a one-week fellowship called Take Point back in 2016. The goal of that program was to elevate the voices of post 9/11 veterans in international policy. And it was a nonprofit pitch competition to get other veterans engaged in international policy. At the time, my project pitch was the Veterans Energy Seminar, which was to educate other military veterans on energy security, to help them see how careers in the energy industry would help them contribute to or improve our national security. And it was actually based on training that the State Department does for foreign service officers. They have a week-long program very similar to that where they provide a crash course in energy fundamentals to non-energy people. They're going to go out all over the world and have to deal with these issues so that they have some basic understanding. So the Atlantic Council, unfortunately, I didn't win the pitch competition. In fact, the War Horse Journal that I wrote that article for was the winner that year. But the council liked the idea. They encouraged me to continue. I did a pilot here in Chicago, followed by events in Boston and San Diego the next year. And so I was very fortunate that they were interested in continuing that partnership. And they actually took on the program under their Global Energy Center. And we had the first Veterans Advanced Energy Summit, kind of a bigger and better version of what I had already done. And in order to lead that program, I joined the team as a non-resident senior fellow, also contributing my nuclear and scientific expertise to the council.
That's awesome. And I've had a couple people on the show who have had experience at a think tank, but I still, like, my memory of this is kind of like a mix of Harry Potter or picturing you with a pipe and smoking and having elaborate conversations. What does it actually look like? Are you, like, what does the work look like when you're working with a think tank?
The work that we're doing is advocating for veteran education and employment. There is some research elements to that, but it is mostly about community building. I am also a fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, another think tank located here in the Midwest. And in that role, it's much more research oriented, where I'm going to be looking at the risks and rewards for working with international partners on risky science, like the things that we do here at Argonne. So, you know, think tanks can be research-oriented, that can be advocacy and community building, and then they can also be political.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of community building, you also founded the Veterans Advanced Energy Summit. What do you want listeners to know about that organization?
So the Veterans Advanced Energy Summit just occurred in August of 2019. We brought together 165 veterans and energy professionals for a day of learning from experts across the energy industry, academics, and government. The main two goals from the day is to learn about energy security issues and to network with other people in the advanced energy sector. It is definitely not a job fair. I've had some experience with that, and I don't always find them to be super effective. It's about putting the right people in the room together to make those connections and find those opportunities for themselves. The Atlantic Council was very pleased with the success of the event, and so we are now preparing to expand beyond just the summit itself to include a fellowship for high-performing, high-potential veterans that we can invest more time and resources into their education and development, as well as more events around the country and throughout the year.
Hmm. One of the things that I love about my perception of your story is we talked about alignment earlier, but you are all in on energy. And yeah. What I respect is I'm hearing about multiple different uses of your time that I'm guessing are scratching different itches of what excites you and your creativity, and it's networking you and all these different things, but they're all pushing in one single direction, which is around clean energy. And I'm just curious if there's anything you'd like to share about that. Like, it seems like a lot of balls that you're juggling simultaneously, but I'm also imagining there's a lot of benefit that comes from having different groups and networks and things like that. So what is it like for you having all of these simultaneous titles and involvements?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is all closely related to the climate change challenge. I look at that as possibly the greatest global challenge that certainly that we're facing today and maybe that we've ever faced. And I look at the national security implications that's going to have with increased weather, severe weather events, rising seawater levels, droughts and resource shortages and migration. That's going to cause friction between countries, but then also put new demands on our military. The government and the military are well prepared, but the energy industry is only just now starting to make the changes that are going to be necessary to mitigate the worst effects. And this is why the Veterans Advanced Energy Summit exists. It is to show that while the energy industry at large needs veterans of all kinds for their technical and soft skills, I think that the clean energy sector have the lowest unemployment rate I think in history at 2.5%, even lower than the national average. But underemployment is really a big challenge still, upwards of 20-25%. And underemployment would be feeling underutilized, overqualified, or unfulfilled. And here I think that clean energy gives an opportunity for veterans to find that mission alignment in the facts that the transition to clean energy is going to make our national security better by, reducing our reliance on foreign fuels, by making our domestic systems more resilient against both cyber and physical threats, by mitigating the impacts that climate change is going to have on our military and international relations, as well as the investments that are going into that, both from the science and the economic perspectives that are going to give us the soft power necessary to continue projecting U.S. values well into the future.
And one of the things I'm teasing out of this that I really appreciate is the clear values. Like, I'm imagining a very, very big value for you is contributing to our national security. And I think that many listeners can relate to that. That probably drove their military service. But I love how you have pivoted around that. There are so many ways of meeting that need. And you've identified one that connects with you on a fundamental level while still meeting that need. And it's very different than the work you did in the military, and yet it's contributing to the exact same purpose. And I think that that's a great example for listeners to realize that as you uncover these values, there's many ways to meet those needs, and it may look dramatically different than what you did in the military while still pushing in that same direction. And I think that I really appreciate that with your with what you're doing right now.
Yeah, I've been in the same job almost 7 years since my transition out of the military, and that's rather uncommon for most folks that are in that transition. And I think that the reason, or maybe I can attribute that success to the fact that I do personally feel so closely aligned with the mission that we have here today. And I tell people I might not like my job every single day, but I love what I do. And it feels good knowing that you're part of something bigger than yourself, much like service in the military.
Well, let's kind of continue on that thread. So there's 8 million energy jobs in America today, approximately 10% of which are held by military veterans. Why do you think that veterans are a good fit for the clean energy sector?
You know, in many of the ways that we've been discussing, the veterans, or I guess in their military service, are all out all over the world operating the energy systems that keep the mission going, both at bases and forward deployed. So they have that hands-on, those hands-on technical skills, but that the military also gives them desirable soft skills like leadership, decision making, and performance under pressure. And the combination of those two really is desirable from within the energy industry. That's not to say that the transition doesn't have its challenges. You know, helping prepare those veterans for the jobs that they want, helping connect them with the companies that are looking, making sure you have the right job for the right candidate, but then also motivating them behind the mission that the energy industry has.
And one thing that occurs to me as you say that, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems like you've pursued a career path in clean energy on the public side of things, working with the government. And there's another path that I'm imagining would be more in the private sector of going to individual companies who are doing something in with clean energy. Could you give maybe the high level for listeners on maybe like a pro-con on the public side versus the private side so they could consider which one might be the right fit for them?
Yeah, absolutely. The public approach that I've taken is really, like I said, about feeling that the government service would be an easy transition to make just based on those similarities. But there are many more jobs in the private industry. For folks with a business acumen or interest, that would be of more interest. There are others that may have a more academic approach to those issues, interested in going back for higher education and getting involved on the policy and the politics side of energy. And then energy entrepreneurship right now, especially in clean energy, is a very popular and desirable place for veterans to go. Because I think that in big industry, like the government, while you may feel safe and you have the benefits and the security like you did in the military, you're also going to find it very hard to find the challenges and the level of responsibility that you had in the military. And I think that going out and starting your own company, taking those risks and having the responsibility for everything that happens really suits a veteran's personality.
That's great. And you are right now pursuing a master's in public policy, is that correct?
So I actually finished in June.
Okay.
Which you're right, was a part-time program at the University of Chicago in the Hare School of Public Policy. I was the first class of that cohort, So a little bit of a guinea pig, and everything was fantastic, really exceeded expectations. And for me, it helped bring together a lot of these efforts that I've been working with at the Atlantic Council, Chicago Council Truman Project, gave me the academic chops to back that up and propel and excel the work that I'm doing today.
Mm. What advice do you have about resources? So maybe someone listening gets fired up about clean energy, either on the public or private side of things. Are there any books or websites, podcasts, blogs, anything that you find that you enjoy that they might want to check out?
So I would check out the Atlantic Council Global Energy Center channels. There are many resources there dealing with the intersection of energy policy and diplomacy. One of their senior fellows has a podcast called Political Climate that's looking at what's happening related to climate and energy policy on the Hill from, and I guess around the country, from a bipartisan perspective that I've been listening to and really enjoy.
Perfect. And for listeners, I'll include links of those to those in the show notes, as well as links to the Veterans Advanced Energy Summit, which is the next one, August 2020, or when is the next one for that?
That's right. Yeah, I think based on the success that we had bringing folks to the Midwest, we are looking at August 2020 here in Chicago.
Mm. I also wanted to ask about... You had said something when we had traded emails. You had said something about dream jobs and that there might be a misperception around that. Could you share a little bit more about your thoughts on that?
Yeah, when I left the military, I had a very inflated sense of marketability. I thought that everybody would just be opening their doors for me. And really, it was a lot harder than that. I also had maybe a very high standards for the work that I wanted to take, trying to find some perfect dream job. And in time, I've realized that there may not be such a thing as someone's dream job. We work hard and we put ourselves on a certain trajectory, but ultimately it comes down to being at the right place at the right time.
Mm. And I love that too. You had said that too. Like it sounds like there's a lot more luck than most people give credit to in pursuing these things and finding that dream opportunity or even finding that first job.
Absolutely. And it may feel like failure day in and day out until it's not.
Mm. I also wanted to ask you about networking as well as emotional and mental support. It seems like given all of these activities, you're a really plugged in individual. And I'm not sure if you've always been that way or if that's kind of come about over time, but any advice for veterans on either how to approach networking or just how to view finding mental and emotional support for one's life?
The time period where I wasn't making any progress finding a job, I mean, I didn't have anything else to do. So I was working out and swimming for the first time in a long time, which obviously was good for my mental balance and stability. I also was going to events around town. There were TED Talks and Chicago Ideas Week, those opportunities where I might find folks with similar interests. And I got really lucky and tapped into what I call the Good People's Network right here in Chicago. And that really was the Truman National Security Project, which is a group of young national security professionals, many veterans, that were willing to donate their time to help me find my cause and my way, that really just had a snowball effect over time.
Mm. I love that sense of establishing one's own good people network and just starting to find people, get advice, get counsel. And I imagine, and as I've seen, as you've founded your own organization, you're now starting to be on the other side of that, of giving back and mentoring and connecting others. But at the start, you were on the receiving end of that. So it's cool to see the flip-flop there.
Yeah, the advice is really just, you got to ask. You got to take the personal initiative to find the people that can help you, and you can usually count on the follow-through.
Mm. Well, I always like to leave the last question open-ended, and I think we covered a lot of ground here. I'm sure there's things we didn't talk about. What else would you want listeners to know before we wrap up?
You had asked in the prompt about USA Jobs any workarounds.
Yeah.
And now that I'm in government service, I actually think networking applies there too. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in an office or a site, find out who works there, reach out to them, see if they're willing to meet you for coffee and get to know you. Because if they are, then you're already building those connections that may help you when the time comes to apply.
One last question. I'm kind of breaking my rule here, but I haven't actually spoken with a lot of people. I've talked to people who have started organizations, but it seems like you've started a group that's primarily about a conference. And I'm wondering if you have any advice on, you know, what was it like starting this conference from the ground up? I'm imagining there's costs associated with the venue, and there's probably aspects of finding sponsors and inviting people. And I'm just curious to learn about what your timeline was like and what advice you have for anyone that wants to organize a conference as well.
The first pilot we did was, I think it took place in December, and I don't think we started organizing until October. It really came together very quickly, and it was a result of those early sponsors that were interested in the idea and wanted to see that happen. And then as the event progressively grew, obviously it took a lot more time and teamwork to make that happen. I would not have been able to do the summit this year if it was not for the staff support that I got from the Atlantic Council and the professionals in their different areas that were able to make that happen. Mm. The advice for someone wanting to start the same thing is finding those early partners that are going to believe in you and help you push along even when things feel like they're falling off.
That's great. I think that there's a lesson there in general of just finding people who believe in you for your career and life and having them to buoy you when you go through those periods of doubt. But it sounds like especially for a conference, it's essential to kind of keep the momentum going.
Absolutely.
Well, Dan, thank you for your time and advice today. For listeners at beyondtheuniform.org, we'll have show notes with links to everything we discussed. There's a lot more here in terms of YouTube videos, Success Bets articles, Warhorse articles. So be sure to check that out, as well as a link to it's the vetsenergysummit.org. We'll have a link there as well. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you, Justin. Surface. Thank
you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Quick couple admin points. We release brand new episodes every single Monday and Thursday. Those are usually recorded about a month or so before they go live. Every Monday and Thursday, we have an interview, usually almost always with a military veteran about their civilian career. More and more, we're starting to add in experts who may not be veterans, but may have some expertise that will help the military veteran community. Saturdays, I typically post more of a behind the scenes episode, which is a free form format. I try to use what I'm calling a mullet format. And by that, I mean business up front, party in the back, talking through admin points, professional topics related to the podcast. It might be a conversation I had that week. It might have been an interview I had that week, but just trying to share things that are top of mind that may help you in more of a free form, straight from the heart format. And then the party in the back is the personal side of things, just kind of more free flowing thoughts on life, on improving oneself, just kind of whatever's going on in life and trying to be authentic and honest about those things as well. Special thanks. We have an all-volunteer army of people behind Beyond the Uniform making this possible. We do this on our lunch breaks, on our evenings, on our weekends, because we love the military community. We want to give back. We want to make a difference. We want that as part of the purpose in our life that we valued in the military. So special thanks to Steve Bain. Steve does pretty much everything. He helps secure guests. He does our newsletter. He keeps the reels rolling and keeps me sane. Kathleen Dillon, the
first person to join our team. She writes text transcripts of every single episode. It's wild. She keeps up with two of these a week despite a demanding career and education right now. But those transcripts help us get more SEO value, helps her audience more. Andrew Woolridge is our data guru. He helps us understand the numbers, which is the easiest way for us to figure out how we can better support you, and adds kind of the data oversight for that. Rick Healy does all of our social media. He is gaining more and more of an audience for us by getting our videos, getting our podcasts out on social channels. The best way to stay in contact with us is if you go to beyondtheinformed.org, there is a newsletter. You'll have a little pop-up that comes up. You can put your email in. We email twice per month. We try to be respectful, but it is a great way to get appraised of upcoming events, upcoming interviews, promos where companies are giving discounts to Beyond the Uniform listeners, and more. This does cost money to put on. We are committed to not charging veterans directly, and the way that we kind of offset costs is through corporate sponsors. So if you know of a company that would like to get in front of a military audience and their families, that's one way that we can both add value to our members, but also offset the costs of Beyond the Uniform and give us a little bit of budget to start expanding what we're doing. So that's the best way you can help us. If that's not something that you can do, a positive review on iTunes is greatly appreciated. Have a wonderful week. We will be back Monday, Thursday, and Saturday with more interviews. And keep up the listening. Take care.